In episode 3 of The Science Behind Feeding Cats, Dr. Carol Smea teaches us about the power behind the feline nose. It's interesting to learn just how much our cats use their smellers to judge their surroundings. Enjoy this one. I'm Jay.
I'm Adrian.
And together we are the Two Crazy Cat Ladies. I'm gonna cut you.
I think I just peed.
Buckle up. We're back in the closet.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for episode number 3, all about the science behind your cat and the way our cats eat with Dr. Carol Smea. We are so blessed to have you back again to teach us something really exciting about cats and their nose. Now, episode number 1 was all about the wild child, right? Like understanding the fact that our cats are so undomesticated, if that's the right
word, non-domesticated.
They're so close to their ancestors. Yeah. Last month was episode number 2, where we learned all about our cat's whiskers, what they are, where they, what they do, what their purpose is, and how we should honor that when feeding our cats, which was so eye-opening to so many, and to learn so much. And then this week we are discussing all about the power behind the feline nose.
Because the nose knows.
Because the nose knows all. Yes, so thank you so much, Dr. Smea, for joining us today. And thank you all as well.
Dr. Smea, since if anyone missed the first 2 episodes, would you do a short intro again for any newbies that we have joining us before we dive right into the nose?
Okay. About me or the pet platter? Okay. Well, I used to be focused on human eating behavior. My background is in psychology and sociology, and I was dealt with a lot of food companies and U.S. government agencies to understand what drives eating behavior. And then one time I was feeding my little Havanese Pip some chicken, and I was cutting it up, and my daughter said, "Don't throw that away, give it to Pip." So I put the cutting board down on the floor, and lo and behold, this little Havanese, who used to inhale her food in about 14 seconds flat and would leave out a horrendous belch, this dog just savored every moment. And after 15 minutes, she looked up at me and it was like, "Let's do this again." And so when my husband came home, I told him about it. He said, "Eureka." He was a product designer. And so we went on a journey of 4 to 5 years to understand the instinctive feeding habits of dogs and cats. And what we realized is, you know, they share a great deal of their DNA. They can still inbreed between the wild version and the domesticated version. And when you start looking into who they are, their sensory circuit, their physiology, they're actually very close. So the pet platter is designed to elicit instinctive feeding behaviors that will provide a healthy eating experience for your pet, because feeding from a bowl is counterproductive to who they are. And that's sort of a brief introduction.
I love it.
What I love though too about this series is, and I think everyone here will probably is absorbing this right now, Jay and I have been obsessed with the pet platter.
And you.
The Mind Pet Platter.
Since
we met you though, and we really do love the way that it really enhances our cat's mealtime experience. And what I love about this series is that, you know, yeah, a product started this in a way, but I love that people get to see the passion and the purpose behind a product and all the science that goes into why this is so significant. So let's dive in.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because everything we've done is to work with people in the industry, examine all the research, go into the journal articles. I've done thousands of hours of observations on how animals deconstruct carcasses. Not that I won't go into detail on that tonight, but it is so real. And, you know, this is all about eating from a cat's perspective, not your perspective. It's looking at who they are and what they need from you. So actually, they're communicating a lot. We need to just understand what they're really saying.
Yes. Yeah. I love this so
100%.
Much.
So tonight, we're discussing all things no's when it comes to our cat's nose. So what
where
is
do you
it?
Want to start with this?
Yeah,
because there's so much.
There is a lot. And let's face it, those cute little noses are everything, right?
Right.
And the nickname is nose leather because it is just a tougher form of skin that is hairless. But I want to ask you guys a question. Is each cat nose print unique or not?
I would assume as such.
Right?
Yes. I would assume that, yes, they are. I mean,
We've seen it on the interwebs, Dr.
Well, interestingly enough, wherever you read, everybody talks about the nose print being unique. Okay. Right. There's only one thing about it. There has never been an official study on it. And the closest that's been done was actually on dogs. And it was for about 2 years looking at dogs after their first born and following it for 2 years. There have been a few on cat litters where, you know, they look to see if they're unique and they'll follow them for a few months. But there's really been no longitudinal study. It's one of those tales that gets started and everybody keeps repeating it. But it was just extrapolated from these smaller studies. And the reason why I wanted to bring that up with your audience tonight is right now there are a number of companies who are working on nose scans for pets, especially for insurance purposes. And you know, I don't know if the science is there yet, and I don't know when these scans will be coming into the marketplace, but I think we need to look at some of the research a little bit more before we start investing money in this, because technically it could replace the microchips that, you know, we have in our pets. But the science isn't quite there. So it's just one of those interesting things. It's like any other field. A story gets started and it just keeps on repeating over and over. So
wait, you mean, so you mean that the nose scan could kind of be like a fingerprint is for us. And
right.
So it could trace their DNA or their names, or we register by scanning them instead of a microchip.
It could actually identify if that's your cat or not.
But this is fascinating, though, Dr. Samantha, because we got to chat just a second offline before we went. And I do think it's fascinating. What a great reminder for all of us. Just because we read something on the internet multiple times by multiple sources does not necessarily mean that it's true. Because when we first learned about the nose, I thought it was so cute. And I was like, I wonder if they tested siblings or litter mates or how did they do that study? Mr. Milligan is here. He said, good luck trying to get a nose print off a cat, right? So I was like, how did they find that out? And I couldn't find anything either, but certainly would love to believe that it's as unique as our own fingerprints.
Yeah.
Love it. Bring this up.
Well, and you know what? Sometimes there are these small studies that are done and people don't necessarily look at the sample side or, you know, what is the statistical significance that they found and what variations do you find? So unless you know the experimental design and put some understanding behind that, you know, the story just continues on. So I don't want to underestimate those studies, but all I'm saying is there's no full-fledged study out there that stamps this as scientifically proven. So,
okay.
I love it.
So, and also with these things coming into the marketplace, which I'm sure they will be, I want to make sure cat parents do some investigation before, you know, they start looking into this. And it isn't easy to get a nose print from a cat, but I'm sure I'll figure that out.
I can only imagine.
But anyway, just a couple of other things I'm sure people know about it. There's a whole variety of noses for cats, the Roman, the snub nose, straight, the nose break. These are all sort of common variations that you see. But the color is genetically determined. And it really depends on the color of their fur. And I want to go back to that Stanford study that I talked about before. You know, there are certain cats that are a solid color, certain ones that have stripes. The stripes probably lived from an ancestral perspective in more grasslands, the solid colors more in desert land, then of course the spotted ones more in where there's heavy foliage. Well, when you think about it, there is a gene that determines that. They found that in the skin, you can actually find thicker skin where the darker hair is going to come up. And even for all white cats, you will still see variations in the skin. There's still variations in there. But I wasn't able to find anything specifically on the nose, but genetically, and to survive from an evolutionary perspective, you wouldn't want a nose that is an outrageous color that's going to be identified either in the grass or, you know, it just doesn't make sense. So somehow Stanford's doing more and more finding, working on that gene that determines the color, but it is genetically linked.
Okay. Wow.
Can you repeat what you said about the skin though? Are you saying that cats that are like, we've got our little Black Panthers, Friday and Zorro, mm-hmm. is their skin thicker than say Jack, who is white and gray?
You'll find different thickness in the skin where the different colors come out.
Wow.
Okay. But even for like a solid black cat, from all everything that I've researched so far, is that there are still variations in there. But when you go down to the skin, that you can see that in the actual skin, but the color fur coming out reflects that.
That's
wow. That's so cool. But
from an evolutionary perspective, this had to happen because if their coats and the markings that they had didn't fit into their environment, they were more easily to be prey right. than the predator. So, but again, a lot isn't done in the area of cats. And I'm hoping that as we start getting into this more, people are going to be asking for more information from researchers.
Yes.
Also, the thing that I'm sure most people know is that your cat's nose can go from light to dark, okay, especially the pink. And it can change color simply because heart rate and blood pressure can go up due to excitement or stress, and any kind of temperature change as well. So the cat's nose is also communicating to you what kind of state that they're in. And it's one of those things, the nose is cute, but it's also communicating to the pet parent as well. And one other thing I thought was important is I did some investigation about serious changes in color, such as white, okay, which commonly is, it can be attributed to a number of things, but when you see your cat's nose go white, there's something else going on, which could either be dehydration, hypothermia, frostbite, could be skin cancer, and even diabetes. So when you see that kind of change, it should be sort of a warning signal, like time to go to my vet or at least call my vet. So again, the nose is communicating to you. It's a communication device. Okay. Do you know what the little line is in their nose?
No, that's
the philtrum. And what that basically does is to collect the moisture from the glands on the side and the moisture from the lips to bring the moisture up to the nose. Okay. So it actually serves a purpose. The reason it's there. And I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting. That's interesting. Fascinating.
I have one too, you know.
Not as big as a cat's nose, though. just reiterate that for a second, because I remember when we got Jack and Madison, both of them Madison is a calico, Jack is white and gray. And the variation in nose color has always been fascinating. But with those two, they're litter mates. I did notice they would go from like bright pink, perfect little nose to very light and usually while they were resting, but it was I was concerned about it. So I think there's a difference between that variation that we will see with some noses that will vary a bit, but the white thing is what needs to be a concern, right? Just to, I'm passing it back to you, that the variation is normal.
No, exactly. And the only reason I like sharing this is because sometimes, you know, we think we may be observing too much with our pets and thinking, oh, you know, we're making too much out of this. But this, from a number of veterinarians, seemed to be something they just want to make pet cat parents aware of, that when you see a dramatic change like that, that means something is going on. And most often it is dehydration. I don't want to panic anybody. But the nose is communicating about the health of the pet as well.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's one of those things. You could look at your cat all day long and learn so much about it.
So true.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. So let's talk about what information does the nose give us other than the possible health issues?
So cats actually use their nose to taste their foods.
Mm.
Okay. For those people who thought that taste was a predominant factor, it is not. And in fact, their sense of smell is what drives their appetite. Now, what another debate that we're having, Adrian, we were talking about this before. I have read that cats have anywhere between 50 million and 200 million scent sites, okay? The literature is sort of scattered all over. And even when I talk to some veterinarians, I'm getting very different responses as well. But nonetheless, the average seemed to be more in the 100 million, 150 million range. But dogs can have up to over 300 million scent sites, okay? So they simply have more, and of course they have more than we do, which is 5 million. But what I thought was so interesting is that when you look at the area for the scent site, for humans, we have about 1.5 square inch where our scent sites are. And then for cats, it's about 8 square inches. And dogs have a much larger, depending on what breed it is. But it just shows you the difference that cats and dogs are still so far superior in their ability to smell than humans are. But cats also have a second hidden nose. It's a Jacobson organ, which I think I spoke to during one of the sessions. And at first, this was just thought to be more in terms of mating, to smell pheromones. And really, they're finding it more related to social activities as well as feeding. So when you see your cat putting his nose back, opening his mouth, and bobbing his head like that. Perfect. What he is doing is the flamen response. Okay. And he is trying to suck in the air. And the Jacobson organ is located between the front small incisors, and that transports up for decoding them. Okay. So dogs and cats do it. I understand that cats tend to do it a little bit more, which makes them interesting again, but it does serve a purpose for them. We also had one at one time, but it no longer works for us. So ours is defunct, the Jacobson organ. Ours is defunct.
I did not know that.
Yep. But ours doesn't work. There's nothing we can do about it anymore. But then the other thing, given that it is really the notion that smell is the dominant factor in eating, when your cat goes up and you're serving a new food, observe them. They won't taste it. They will smell it first.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. And then if they have any sort of congestion, respiratory issue, they have an inability to smell the food, and that will decrease appetite. And that's why cats that have respiratory illnesses tend to lose weight, because there is no appetite. It's completely, well, primarily driven by their sense of smell.
Right.
Yep. I think that's an important point, because we've had a number of people contact us with chronic respiratory issues that so many cats suffer with. And it's like, they think they're dealing with this issue, the respiratory issue, but now they're worried about the weight loss and what's going on. They're not eating.
They're worried about their liver, right? Hepatic lipidosis. Yeah.
It's completely
connected. Right. So it is a major issue, and that's something, to talk about the vet about, and what options do you have to open up those nasal cavities so some sense of smell can come through to stimulate the appetite.
Yes.
And, so I think it's important for different medical conditions as well. But the interesting thing is that, what about the taste buds? Okay. And I'm hoping that this will change people's perspective on feeding their cats. Cats have far fewer taste buds, only 470, compared to dogs, which have 1,700, and 9,000 for humans. So cats are at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to taste buds. And they actually have more difficulty detecting the flavor of foods. The interesting thing, cats are the only mammal that lack a taste receptor for sweet.
Mm-hmm.
The only mammal. And they do have receptors for sour and bitter, which are extremely important, because cats assess toxicity with those taste receptors. Mm-hmm. They also have umami, the savoriness. And they're saying that they possibly have taste buds for fat as well. But then there's another one, ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. And that is thought to be a signal for meat, to signal meat coming in. And they don't really understand this. This has kind of been more of a recent discovery. But this is a compound that supplies energy in all living cells, so it's critical to their survival. So hopefully, at some point in time, when we get more information on this, we'll be able to share it with your audience. But again, cats are very different than other animals, and especially from us.
I love this point, because when we were learning about the number of taste buds and how they don't have the sweet receptor and all of that, and how many more dogs have and how many more people have, I think it's so appropriate to realize we're herbivores, carnivores, like we can eat lots of stuff and things. Dogs are scavenging carnivores. They can eat lots of stuff and things. Cats are obligate carnivores. It is as if, voila, evolution itself has created them to know that they need real meat.
Right.
And they don't need all the other bells and whistles. That's what their bodies need.
That's an excellent point, because when you think about it, it's like, wow, evolution. Nature has a way of taking care of itself. And all we have to do is look at their ancestors and sort of follow this.
Yeah.
Go to the zoo, look at wild cats, see how they act. It's exactly like your cat. Okay. So it brings it, but evolution obviously plays a role in all this and how they survive in the wild. So I think it's really interesting. I'll make sure I keep on looking for stuff to bring forward them, but I thought that was exciting. But now let's get to the nitty gritty. Okay. Because cats are different. They're special. They're always operating in a different realm, especially from dogs. So the one thing I want to share with everybody tonight is that cats actually use their nose to choose which foods they eat. And what I mean by that is there are three different types of scent receptors. And V1R is a receptor for distinguishing scents. And cats have more V1R receptors. They have more sensitive noses than either cats or humans. So, you know, that those cat facts are sneaking into the equation again.
Wait. Dogs are humans, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. So humans have two V1R receptors. Dogs have 9. And cats have 30.
Wow.
So what that basically means is that what you feed your cat, creating a variety of scents, will help them explore that food and to make choices about what are the nutritional requirements their bodies need.
Yeah.
And again, they're the wild child. They live in the wild. They're solitary hunters. They have to have this information to survive.
Right.
They have to know which prey to go after and what their bodies need. So using these highly aromatic foods can definitely make a difference. And I think, do you want to show something right now, or should I go through some interesting facts before?
I think this is absolutely awesome. So we've been talking with Dr. Smea for a while, right? We got on the subject of charcuterie boards when it comes to especially the Mayan pet platter, because it's the perfect charcuterie board for cats, right? And so this past weekend, because it was Super Bowl weekend, we decided to make a charcuterie board for our cats. And we used chicken, beef, turkey, and duck around the ridge in a freeze-dried form. And then the others there, and I want to show you guys real quick, because this is fascinating to us too, to see which cat went for what aroma. So give me 1 second here and I will show you guys right meow. And you guys see, so Zorro is our black cat that was there, and you see him, he was just sniffing. He was like, turkey, beef, chicken. Do you know what he did, guys? He literally went straight for, after he sniffed everything, he spent the rest of his time going through the ridge of the charcuterie board of the Mayan pet platter and ate out every single piece of duck freeze-dried from the entire thing. And he's not actually the dude that really even likes freeze dried that much. He's more like for the meat, but it's all meat, but he went straight for the duck all the way around the ridge. It was so fascinating to see. Whereas Jack went like straight for the chicken and the beef. He ate half the beef and the chicken. But it's so interesting.
Definitely. I love the charcuterie that you did. It was great.
it's you know, we talk, we have a round table that we do every month with Dr. Woodley and Pam Roussel with Perfectly Holistic and Julian Thorne with Naturally Cats. And they always are talking about self-selection, right? Like letting your cats decide certain things. And we're bad at it too. It's like, what are we going to have today? I mean, we switch up their proteins. We switch up their foods, you know, a lot. They get probably more than most cats get.
More than us.
But we switch it up and we are like, today it's this. And this, you know, this morning it's this. And this evening it's this. It's very rare that we get on that occasion where it's like, let's put it out and let you decide.
Right. You know, it's really interesting because even at the zoo, and this goes across all the animals, we fight food monotony. Okay. If you are constantly giving the same food over and over again, I have seen it with polar bears to, you know, seals, whatever. they are programmed, they need stimulation, thinking, making food choices. Again, I want people to realize they spent 95% of the time in the wild, hunting, foraging, deconstructing carcasses, eating what they nutritionally need. When we took all this away from them, we have to think of how can we replicate this in our house? How can we bring back the joy? Because like with cats especially, there's pride in killing things. And even if they're eating at the time, they will stop eating. I cited that experiment. When they heard, I think it was a mouse or something in another room, they would stop eating, okay, a sure-fired meal right in front of them. They would go kill the mouse, bring it back, put it right by the bowl. Why? Because they're programmed to always have food for the next meal. And they just couldn't, all the cat, I think only one cat out of the whole experiment did not go to get the mouse, which is really amazing. So it shows this programming. But if you are given the same meal day in and day out, you lose your appetite for it as well. And also, it's creating sort of a variety of what they have to do to get it. So if you serve it the same way from the same bowl or platter or whatever you're serving from, that gets old too. But creating this notion of a charcuterie, making them explore, and we'll talk about later on in some of our future episodes, where can you put the pet platter? How can the pet platter, the feline feeding field, this is a field that you can create for them and create dynamics that you'll see your cat do that you've never seen them do before. So it's us getting out of our habit and saying, how can we go back in and create this for our cats?
Yeah. Yeah. And Dr. Smith, I think you kind of already addressed this, but I want to bring up Christy's comment here, which I think is fascinating because I think food monotony is a real thing. And I think that people have experienced that. In for cat parents, though, they've also experienced food addiction. You know, when we're dealing with kibbles and different palatants and all that, then it's very difficult. But Christy's comment is, so despite my vet saying to keep him on one protein and don't switch too often, this speaks to variety being key.
And
you know, I think we're looking at breaking addictions and that food monotony as well.
Well, and I mean, at the same time, just going to throw in here a punch about the microbiome, right? Like, I mean, there is so much science around the microbiome of our cat's guts and feeding them the same thing over and over and over again. All the test results show that we have a less healthy gut microbiome versus adding variety to the diet, adding, you know, switching up those proteins as often as possible. And yes, I think it was Madison, it's okay to give a different protein every day if your cat is, you know, not sensitive, and we, you know, sometimes we have to slowly change that if it introduce a new protein or a new food. If your cat has a sensitive gut, which is usually from feeding the exact same food over and over and over again, then, you know,
hopefully that's all it is.
but it is the variety, allowing them that self-selection, allowing them to choose what they want. I just love this.
Yeah, self-selection, so I think, is so, it's a beautiful thing to watch with, you know, Julianne Thorne with Naturally Cats. She does that with her herb gardens, and it's amazing to watch. It was fascinating for us. A quick question from Mr. Rob Milligan as well. I don't know if you saw any of this in your research, but is it possible for these receptors to be shared between siblings? In other words, if he feeds his
freeloaders,
his little loves, this different foods, they'll turn their nose up at the same foods or they'll like the same foods. Did you see anything about
nothing? No research like that has been done, but keep bringing these questions up. We'll get the researchers to do more and more in this area, but great question. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Okay. Well, I just thought I'd end with a few, little pieces of information. Because their noses are so powerful, we really need to pay attention to the aromas that we do have in our house. And it was really interesting. I've come across some stuff that shows that really strong odors can not only, you know, cause discomfort, but the point of an overload where it's almost painful to your cats. And I know most of your people know, you know, citrus smells are taboo and things like that, but also aerosol sprays, room deodorizers, and of course, cat litter that is scented. But let me tell you, it's a lot of people use it. The fragrances used in those are so strong and so powerful. Just, you know, if you're going to use anything, and especially with candles, because that oil gets into the lining, just be very, very careful about what you use, because their membranes soak this up and those oils stick to that membrane and it can cause really, really serious problems.
Yeah, okay? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like such asthma, allergies, all of the, like the household and also chemicals, right? Like the floor cleaners that we use. We used to use, and we tell this story all the time, but we used to use all of said above. I love the Yankee candles. Every Christmas, it was like, I spend so much money on these. All year long, we had plug-ins in several different rooms. We used the aerosol sprays. We had a cat with asthma and had no idea that these things were affecting. I had to get Swiffer. Like every cleaner that I had to smell this strong smell. And I had no idea that this was affecting our cat so negatively at that time. And I mean, now, you know, you want a good smelling house, open the window, let it smell like fall, you know, like we have air purifiers that, you know, like these are the things that we use now versus in the past, because we did not know better. And once we know better, we can do better. So yeah, all of that is important. However, I do want to ask you about this, because Emma Rutherford, who is a beautiful genius formulator, and she formulates foods, many different raw food brands around the world. She was one of the first to tell us, not necessarily about whisker stress, we knew about that, but she was talking about the aroma when you feed your cat from a bowl, how strong that is, that it can be so, like, they can not like it. Basically, it can be way too strong for them because it's concentrated in a bowl. And right. She said, feed from wooden platter. You must feed from a platter because the aroma is allowed to, you know, and she was explaining that to us. What do you say about that? Are you finding the same thing with the bowls?
Absolutely. Because you know what? The sides contain that aroma, but think of it, you're piling that all together. Okay. So all that aroma is sitting there in one big pile. And when that nose comes down, it's scent overload without a doubt. So that's why with the pet platter, by spreading it all out across a wider surface, you're never going to have that. But also you're giving them the ability to engage their V1R scent receptors by looking and smelling the different aromas there to really get a taste of what they want to eat then. So a bowl also shuts down who they are instinctively. It shuts down their ability to taste their food through their sense of smell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think,
it makes sense. Like if you think about it, like you just test it yourself, right? Put some cat food or anything in a bowl and then put your face in it and smell it. And then put it on a plate. We only have 5 million of these scent sensors. Now multiply that by a lot. I don't know math, but they have 100 to 150 million, right? Like if it smells stronger to us, imagine what that does to our cats.
Well, and another interesting thing is that when kittens are first born, their sense of smell is the first sense to develop. Okay, they can't see and they can't hear. And the reason for that is they can smell where the mother is, but also some kittens prefer certain teats and they pick up on the smell of that and it directs them where to go. Wow. So when you think about the sense of smell being the first one to develop, that shows you how critical it is to the physiological functioning of the cat.
Wow.
It's incredible. I know we kind of started this talking about how, you know, your passion for the Mind Pet Plotter is really our, us being super fans of it and seeing what a difference it made for our babies. You know, we would always do the wide bowls, right? But this was a whole different experience to watch them kind of roam around and play with the divots and get the juices and the ridges and all that. And Misty had a kind of a question here.
Well, and for those of you that are asking, where can I get it? The link is in the description here, and we actually have a discount code. They have a discount code for you too. So you guys can click the link in the description to get
I think that this is a common issue that a lot of cat parents deal with. What Misty's talking about, what about extremely picky kitties that do not like high-end food, tried extremely expensive stuff, good ingredients, but they both didn't like any of them. And I think that there's something to be said about, we can try the same thing depending on how we're feeding them, giving them those different options, and, you know, doing something on a platter versus putting it in their old bowl. Certainly when it comes to, I don't think anyone here actually feeds in plastic bowls anymore. And very important to note, you guys, the Mind Pet Platters are not plastic. They are cellulose fiber.
Which is like the most organic molecule on the planet. Love it.
Right. Incredibly easy to clean, but it gives them that option. I think, you know, we talk about food monotony. There's also a sense of that food addiction as well, where cats can be a little apprehensive to try new things. So when we really engage their senses, all of them, and give them options in a way that they're more receptive to, yeah, I think make a big difference.
Yeah. And I would, I mean, like as a little tip there, whatever you're feeding them now that they are maybe addicted to, then do the charcuterie board style, right? Like put out the good, nice, expensive food, but put that food there. So then they are going to now start to, because their nose is so powerful, they smell this other food while they're eating the food that they're used to. And now they are registering that as food versus, you know, oftentimes it's texture and things like that, that we switch up and they don't even register it as food necessarily because they're so addicted or used to this type of food. This will help. The charcuterie board style will really help with that.
Well, and let me share one thing with you. It's very interesting because we've had a lot of pet parents contact us after they tried the pet platter, because a lot of people go, oh, you know, it's, you know, just a board, you know, no big deal, blah, blah, blah. Well, what they found is that after they switched to the pet platter, the cat and dog will not go back to eat from the bowl. They'll sit there and wait until the food is put on the platter. So our saying of how you feed is just as important as what you feed comes to play here. So if your cat had serious whisker fatigue with that banging in, they don't want to go through that. They will turn their back on food that they want and food that they need if it is creating an uncomfortable situation. But most finicky eating that I have found is typically related to the environment in which you're serving them in and the serving device that you're serving them from. And it could be heightened anxiety. You know, cats have that better peripheral vision. They have superior motion detection. So for some bowls, especially stainless steel, they see movement reflecting in the bowl. They're gonna walk away from that because they can't detect if there's a potential threat in there. And they're basically blocked in. They have no way to escape. And one thing about the pet platter is you'll find that your cat will like locate their position probably at one end of the platter. So it will give them the ability to jump up to 9 feet should anything come in to try to get at them or get to their food, because that is their autonomic nervous response to be able to flee. When they have their head in a bowl, they can't do that. They can't see what's coming around. So not that this is all going to be solved, but finicky eating, a lot of it is related to how you're serving it. And the feeding environment. Always feed the platter. We recommend pulling it away from a corner, because when you put your pet in a corner, you're blocking all of their sensory input. So they're hearing all these noises at frequencies. They're hearing noises that we can't hear at all. Then there's motion in the bowl, hearing noises, can't really see on the side of them. So it creates a threatening feeding environment. Always pull it away from a wall. Allow them to circle their prey. They did this in the wild, okay? They will circle to make sure nobody else can come in and get that food. So another thing is, if it is really noisy or a high traffic area, that can interrupt feeding as well. Yeah. So if you find finicky eating, try to take it, locate it elsewhere where people aren't running through or there's not a lot of activity. It really does make a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, it does. Some of our cats prefer to eat away from all the rest of the cats, even if they get along just fine. When it comes to eating time, it's a very vulnerable time, and they prefer to be away or up high. So if I feed them on, like even Jack, like he ate fine on top of the couch, but on the floor, he gets a little worried about what's going on. But if he's up a little bit higher, then he's more apt to eat. I want to address Gloria's question right here, just right now. And we're going to tell you guys a lot about this, but my pet platter is so the thing I absolutely, as a person, what I absolutely love the most. The question is, what's the best way to clean these platters? Now, they are dishwasher safe, so you can throw them in the dishwasher. We don't have a dishwasher. Well, we have a dishwasher, but it doesn't work very well. And we feed several times a day, and so we just don't run it. We wash them by hand, but I freaking love how easy these things are to clean. I can literally, even if, and I was saying this yesterday, and we don't recommend it, but if we feed our cats late at night, and then we just go to bed, and we get up in the morning, and I do the feeding in the morning, and there's raw food. Dried remnants of raw food on the platter or leftover that they're like, I wasn't hungry. I didn't want that. I can put it over hot water, like literally just run water. It doesn't have to be hot water. I always turn it on hot, but it just falls right off.
In stark contrast to stainless steel and glass.
Yeah, stainless steel is hard to clean.
You would be using a SOS pad on that to try to get it off for a very long time.
This is very super easy. Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, another thing that I like to tell people, and this goes for your own dishes as well. Don't use abrasive material if you don't have to. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because all you're doing is wearing it down and you don't need to. An abrasive thing will always, you know, impact marble, whatever. Just use what is absolutely necessary, but everything with the pet platter, unlike lick type mats where food gets caught, everything about the pet platter is designed so the cat's tongue can fit in there and they can literally get at every speck of food. So there's total satisfaction because they want to get to the food and they want a successful feeding experience. So I know some people, they contact us about abrasive brushes and scrape, and I'm like, no, you don't need to do that.
It's incredible. It's so easy.
I'm seeing a couple questions coming in about elevating the platter, and we do that for our Oliver Twist, who is also 19. We put it on a box for him, nothing fancy, and that's great. It's a little better on his joints, but we also do it for Jack, who seems to have a bit of food insecurity at times. So just lifting it up a little bit for him also works well. Misty asked also about kind of weaning them off different foods. I really think that had we had this Mind Pet Platter back when we were really learning how to transition, you know, at that point we were feeding out of bowls and we would put the new food near the other food, but still when they're in this, they're not necessarily exploring that. So yes, you could see where, hey, sorry about that. This little guy needs to go
away. I just blocked him. Go ahead. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. It's okay.
Sorry about that. But yeah, that where you're giving them that opportunity to self-select. And that would have been awesome to help wean them off of the foods that we were trying to wean them off of while giving them options, because science, the studies do show that cats over time, given the choice of self-selection, will choose, as you just explored with how their receptors all work, they will choose what their body needs. So over time, they will choose the more nutritious food.
Right. And yes. There's a beautiful study done in the UK, and Dr. Karen Becker cites it on her website as well. It's they had three different types of food that they offered, like a clowder of cats. And one of them was just to see what would the cats go for. Two of them were completely unbalanced, and they just weren't everything that the cats needed. But one was fish, one was chicken, I believe. Ooh. And the third one was an orange flavored food, which is citrus, which turns cats off, right? However, the orange flavored food was complete and balanced. It had all the nutrients that the cats needed. So in the beginning of the study, they all went for the fish first because that smell, right? So they all went to the fish first. And then over a short amount of time, they went over to the chicken because they realized that's not everything that my body needs. But by the end of the study, every single one of the cats were eating the orange flavored food because it had everything that their bodies needed.
To your point on there being science for what is the receptor that gives energy to the whole body?
Oh, the ATP that I was talking about?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Like, what a beautiful mystery.
Yes.
I think
adenosine triphosphate. And, you know, there has to be something there. And this brings up another issue. And I know diabetes is a problem for some cats. The interesting thing is the fact that cats can't taste sweetness, they won't walk away from it because they can't taste it. So is the lack of that taste bud actually detrimental to them because they're going to eat things with grains, right? A lot of the food, 20% of the content of some foods will contain grains, which become problematic. So this is where nobody knows, is it because they lacked it or did something transpire where they lost that particular taste bud? And that's leading to diabetes now. But it's a really interesting thing for pet parents to realize, like some people say, well, cats love ice cream, okay? They're probably reacting more to the fat, yeah. Okay? Not the sweetness. It's the fat within sweets that is driving that. So yeah. It's just an interesting thing how evolution and the whole notion of this lack of a sweet taste bud impacts their lives.
Well, and thinking about diabetes specifically and the fact that, you know, I think they say like 98% of cat parents still feed a kibble diet to their cats, mm-hmm. Which is really high in starch and carbohydrates and grains, right? Like that actually break down into sugar in the body and create things like diabetes. But the key is what the manufacturers are brilliant about is knowing that feline nose is so important that they spray it. They spray these kibbles with these palatants, with this animal digest, with these things that make the cats, it's the smell that makes cats really want that unhealthy food that's going to cause diabetes, kidney disease, and other things.
And if that's their only choice, I think that we're seeing, we've lived through what happens when that is the only choice. Right. And again, just that not only do we have this amazing opportunity to give our cats the let them exercise their instincts and their amazing everything by giving them options, giving them some self-selection, giving them that kind of empowerment and enrichment. I just think that it's
fascinating.
It's a beautiful thing. I love that, you know, this whole series, and we've got a couple more coming for you guys. This whole series just kind of came to fruition because we were obsessed with the Mind Pet Platter. Then we got to meet you and now we're obsessed with you. Realizing
I'm obsessed with you.
Adopted Carol, just so you guys know, yes. Dr. Smith.
She has her own room in our home.
I'm going to be vacationing there soon, so we'll do a special one from
the studio. Yes.
But I'm just so grateful for learning more about the passion and the research and the intention that went into creating this product that we love so much. And I love so much being able to share all these myth busting, all the stuff and things that, you know, you really do go 150% with your research. You are next.
Well, you know what? Thank you for giving me this platform. And the thing is, there is a tremendous amount to respect in the cat world. And I think the more we get this information out there and share it, I think cats are underserved right now. And people really don't recognize the special creatures and talents that they have. And if we can start voicing this and getting it out into the pet community, we're gonna really elevate cats to where they need to be. So thank you for giving me a platform to do this.